Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by an old friend who hasn't been with us for some time. John, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
So, John, you've been traveling and had a, no doubt, terrific time. Thank you for coming back to join us on the VFX show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
And also by Ian, a relatively new newbie in our midst, but somewhat experienced. When were you last on with us, Ian?
I did the True Lies VFX show.
Yes, a classic. In fact, I think both we agreed both favourites of ours. So this week on the show, we're going to be talking about Alice in Wonderland, the Tim Burton 3D sequel, I guess, to the traditional Alice in Wonderland. We're going to probably focus pretty much on the visual effects, touch a little bit on the 3D because it's a little controversial. But as we always like to do, let's start with chatting about the film in general and whether we liked it or not. And I guess, Ian, to you first, did you enjoy the film?
I did. I thought it was a really fun film. I think I saw it with a bunch of about 10 mates in 3D, and we all came out of it a little bit thinking that it was a little bit Disney-esque for a Tim Burton film. But generally, you know, we had a lot of fun. And I actually am really starting to enjoy going along to the cinema and wearing the glasses, and I just kind of find that a sort of a bit of a fun event.
Ah, freak. And what about you, John?
No, I would agree with it. I would agree with Ian, the assessment of it, of the film. I liked it. I didn't love it. I have actually a lot of tiny little issues with it. Nothing really overarching. I liked the world a lot. I enjoyed the story. It was the characters themselves that kind of came unglued for me. And I don't know if you read the Roger Ebert review of the movie, but I think the Roger Ebert review summed it up really well, which was that the first two acts were really great, but then it just kind of fell apart in the third act. So I think that would be an accurate assessment. When Johnny Depp started dancing, I sort of lost interest in what happened after that.
Well, that was at the end of the film. I really liked the film. I didn't like it to the point of saying it was, you know, the greatest Tim Burton film ever, but I definitely thought it was really, really good. I thought Ken Rolston heading up the visual effects team did a superb job, and we're going to discuss that in a second. I guess for me, I will say, as much as I loved it to death and particularly loved the art direction, the design, the world and the visual effects, I was disappointed in the 3D because it was stereoscopically done by producing 3D stereoscopic imagery from a flat 2D image. So that was a disappointment to me, and I guess for many people, that this point has been raised that this process of turning 2D films into 3D, extremely difficult, not in any way cheap or an automated process, and really, I guess that's the second theme we might touch on today. As we always like to have a bit of a tech secondary theme, is whether or not we think that that is a valid approach. But I guess from the sound of things, you know, Ian, you kind of liked it, but probably not in love with it. But I guess the thing is, for me, I didn't go expecting to like it. I actually went with my daughter, and I thought, you know, this is going to be a bit gimmicky, and it's going to be, I'm not going to like the fact that it was a bit, you know, predisposed, having read Jim Cameron's comments about how appalled he was that they were doing 3D extraction from 2. I was thinking, well, I am not going to enjoy this because I'm a bit sensitive to 3D. I don't like it when it's done poorly. I didn't think I was going to like it because I'd just seen the, you know, trailers and thought it looked a bit hokey. And I was thinking, not sort of hokey from a visual effects quality point of view, just from a, like, it was going to be not a particularly engaging story. And one of the things that I really like at the film level was Johnny Depp's performance, because I really thought that he brought a lot more to that performance than I was expecting. I expected the Mad Hatter to be just annoyingly, you know, crazy, like, you know, those TV commercials, John, that you get late at night with, you know, like crazy John's like selling furniture or something, like, you know, just completely annoying and wacky.
Right, exactly.
Did you not think Johnny Depp did a good job?
I I'm a little biased. I couldn't stop staring at the black that they put between his teeth to create that space in his teeth. I just kept thinking, surely if they can make Helena Bonham Carter's head larger, they can fix his damn teeth without having to use, you know, some old school techniques. So I was a little disappointed in that. I know that's not his acting, but I just couldn't get past it. but no, I thought his acting was great. I thought his his accent tended to shift a little bit more than I would have wanted. But he definitely, you know, he definitely threw himself into this role, that's for sure.
But wasn't his accent meant to jump around all over the place?
I think it was, but I don't think it was meant to jump in the way that it did. I think he just fell in and out of this strange sort of Baroque, you know, kind of sound quite a bit.
I mean, I guess
but I do know that...
Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I do know that he, you know, he's an artist, and he spent a fair amount of time with Tim Burton, who was also an artist, and they were drawing different sketches together of what this character would look like. So, I mean, he, like I said, he really threw himself into the role, and you can tell on screen.
It wasn't until I came to do the show after I'd seen the film that I actually discovered why the Mad as a Hatter expression existed, that of course leads to the Mad Hatter, which is to do with a line in the film actually where he says, investigating things beginning with M, and apparently they used to use mercury in the glue for hat production. So somebody that was making hats could quite often suffer from mercury poisoning, and as a consequence, Mad as a Hatter was a legitimate kind of sort of based in fact thing, which led to the Mad Hatter. And I guess that was interesting. I never associated the Mad Hatter as anything, but as I say, it's this kind of annoying Looney Tunes kind of bouncing around thing. And then to have another layer on top of that, which as I say, is this kind of pathos of him actually looking genuinely sad and sorrowful at times. I really liked his performance. I thought it was great. I'm going to ask you, Ian, whether or not the trick with the eyes was in enhancing that for you or detracting from it, the fact that they digitally altered his eyes.
Well, I suppose in a way that detracts a little bit from it because it distracts you. But as you're both saying, I think his performance is so good. And I mean, we were all cracking up at his dance in particular. And I mean, just adding on that too, what I really liked about the film, or one thing I liked, was that every character was really different. You could really fall in love with Johnny Depp, or you could really like Alice, and then you could like the Queen. You know, it's sort of typical Tim Burton film that you see so many different characters and there's not one the same. And I think that's, you know, that's what I came out of the film really liking.
Yeah, I'm going to make a brief comment here and lose our G rating. So if you have children in the car and you're listening to this, you might want to jump ahead. But I want to take the motherfucking bastard of the English press who accused Mia of being a heroine that looked like on a heroin and rip his arms from his friggin' body. I think that was the most appalling review. Classic case of someone coming up with a witty one-liner and then wanting to apply it with no relevance to the thing. I thought Mia's performance was great. Now, admittedly, we know her, but because, you know, she was in one of our films, but still, god damn it, I thought she was really good. I thought it was a completely appallingly unreasonable review. I just made my blood boil, bastard. You know, I hate it when people get like really cutesy little remarks and then they just want to use it. But that's my position. Anyone else have want to comment on Mia's performance?
I thought she was great. And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting, isn't it, in the film is that for most of the film, she's the only human character or only unaugmented character in the film. You know, she does grow and shrink. But you start looking around at the other characters in the scene and they're either CG or they've got a big head or their eyes have been altered or, you know, have heaps of makeup on. And so I think she did such a great job of just staying in the human character trait, which I know that's the whole point of the film. Of course, she's in this crazy world. But, you know, I think that would have been a real challenge for her to do, and she did a great job.
John?
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I was going to make a witty one-liner and say that I would have preferred Lindsay Lohan in the role, but I was just going to do that to be silly.
Just to be annoying, because Lindsay Lohan wouldn't do a very good job at all compared to me.
Exactly, exactly. But she wouldn't be a heroine on heroin. So, I thought Mia's performance was fantastic.
Yeah.
I really bought into her. I mean, of all the characters in the film, she was the one that resonated absolutely the most with me. She was the one that seemed the most genuine, you know, the most true to the kind of three-dimensional personality that you might expect from Alice. And if you've ever read the book, that you have come to expect from Alice, you know, she showed a lot of real initiative in the film as an actress. I was totally pleased with her performance. I thought she was a standout.
Yeah, I think she's going to go on to do even more amazing, great work. And I go, the other thing, I guess, for me is that you need a character in Alice to have a certain well, not reservedness, but like normality, just to counterpoint the wackiness that's going on around you. I mean, otherwise the whole thing becomes just silly and you lose interest. In fact, that would be my slight problem with the dance, Ian, and I use that as now a metaphor, is that when you get to a point that you just so detach from reality that anything is possible in any direction, and we've discussed this a couple of times on the VFX show, in the case of the dance, his head swinging band backwards, it's clearly just a big CG kind of shoot out clever thing, then it no longer becomes quite endearing and enchanting. And I think the film runs a risk of that, of just becoming wacky visual effects with wild things, with, you know, people playing with giant heads, and it just would all become a big mismatch. And you need a kind of an anchor of normality, which I think she provided. And also, you don't want that anchor to be cutesy, because you don't want Alice to be, you know, super cutesy. And I didn't think she was Disney-esque cutesy. I didn't think she was pathetic, and I didn't think that she was also ridiculously, heroically not of her time. So, yeah, no, I put a lot of... And what about some of the other characters? And I'm going to discuss them in terms of their visual effects, because obviously we want to do that being the VFX show, because I think each of them has some issues that are interesting vis-a-vis their performances. We discussed Johnny Depp's eyes, which I think is a very dangerous thing to do, playing with an actor's eyes. It's where so much of the performance comes from. I think that was a really bold move. Helena Bonham Carter's giant head, how do we think that played in terms of the visual effects supporting the story, allowing her to perform? John, what did you think?
Well, I just to touch on his eyes real quick before I get into the head, you know, I've been a fan of the sort of eye thing since I read Bloom County. There was a character, Bill the Cat, in Bloom County who had one eye was larger than the other, and that was your way of getting a, you know, sense that Bill the Cat was insane. So when I saw the eye thing, I went, oh, okay, this guy's completely crazy, although we already knew that. I thought it was sort of clever. So that worked a little bit for me because it wasn't so obvious, but it was really interesting. The very large head on the Red Queen, it actually worked for me until there were shots where the camera was sort of at a low angle, and I just couldn't help but think, my God, why is this woman's neck so freaking huge? She had like a linebacker neck for most of the shots, and that just completely threw me out of it, because I felt like the neck was absolutely disproportionate to the way that it should have been, with her shoulders supporting, you know, the head. So that the head worked completely, but the neck didn't. So I don't know if that's...
Well, for those listeners that haven't read, say, the article on VFX on our FX guide about how they did that, it was shot on a Dolsa at high res 4K, and then because it was 4K, the plate of Helena Bonham Carter, they could afford to blow up the head and manipulate it. So it was, in fact, her head from the same performance as her body, separated as she was shot on a green screen environment, as most of the actors were. They could then recomposite her head back on. And the only restriction they placed on her, if you want to call it that, is that they asked her not to bring her hands up to her face, because there'd be all sorts of problems as to where her hands would be relative to her face. And of course her face would have moved, and you'd have to move her face up, and you'd have lost the part of her face behind her hand. So with that restriction of not being able to really move her hands up to her face and having to keep her hands down at her side, in another character might have been a bit of a problem. I think in The Queen, I didn't see that as a major restriction. I thought the neck thing didn't bother me, John. I didn't really even think about it until you mentioned it. There was a couple of shots near the end where I was a little concerned about the line of the neck to the head, where almost every other shot I thought it was just brilliantly composited. If I was giving that individual shot a scorecard, I'd have to say I thought it worked like a 9 out of 10. I thought it was very well achieved for what would have been an easy idea in pre and a bloody hard idea to put into practice. And I thought she was obviously the sort of comic relief evil character, and I thought that worked really, really well. So I think that was a success. I'm going to move to Ian to discussing her sidekick, the one-eyed... Now, is it pronounced Stan or Stain?
Stain, isn't it?
Stain? Right, okay. Stain. Yeah. It's S-T-A-Y-N, I think. Yeah. Now, actually, John, you might know this, or Ian, I don't know. Is Stain a character from the book that I don't know? Is that a new character?
I'm not sure, actually. He's the Knave of Hearts, isn't he?
John, do you know if that's a pre-existing Lewis Carroll creation?
I believe so. I don't know off the top of my head. It's been so long since I've read
Lucky this
book.
Isn't a literary show. our literature is not our strong point. Okay, well, let's just say for a second that we don't care because it's just valid in terms of the film. Let's hear from you first, Ian. What did you think of Stain?
I really like that character. And actually, to be honest, I didn't know for a while that he was augmented, you know, with this sort of elongated legs and or leg extensions. And so I think in terms of the visual effects, they did a great job.
Okay, so I don't get medieval on your ass or anything, but are you frigging kidding? You didn't notice?
Oh, I was going to say the same thing.
Man,
I'm sorry.
It was like, I think, the least successful character in the entire film. I mean, there were so many problems with that character in terms of the quality of the rest of the characters. It wasn't like it was the worst character I've ever seen on screen.
Let me defend myself a little bit and say
you need to, my friend.
my whole reaction to the film was that there was always so much to look at, and you were either looking at Helena Bonham Carter's big head or the other characters in the film or even the sets, and I always found my eyes jumping around, and I suppose maybe that's why it took me a while to realise that he was augmented. And that's my defence.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to say this, I wait to see what you think, John, but I think that the character, the actor, was on stilts, so they extended up his height by sort of a clamped on stilt to his leg. So he's in a green screen sheet with tracking markers, and then he would walk around the set. And obviously, his head was then used in the actual production. His body was replaced with a CG body that was effectively motion captured, but really, in fact, it was more like tracked and matched. And for me, there were three problems. Firstly, I didn't find the fluidity of the movement to be now at the level. If you peg the rest of the film, you take the 9 out of 10 on Helena Bonham Carter's Queen, if that was your benchmark, then unfortunately putting another character right beside her showed up that character. If the film hadn't been such high quality overall, his character wouldn't have maybe stuck out. And then the cloth sims weren't entirely believable for me, some of the movement. And then because of that, to the horse, the jumping off and on the horse, the movement with the horse had an almost game-like, high level, but still game-esque, feel to it in terms of the shader or the look or something. Now, this was rendered with Arnold, which is the new or newish in-house renderer at Sony Image Pictures Works and Sony Pictures Image Works. And Arnold, obviously on Monster House, wasn't going for photorealism. It was on things like Eagle Eye and stuff, but I don't know if that was a limitation out of Arnold or whether it was some other thing. But I've got to say, I think that cloth slim / movement of the body thing didn't really work for me. And then the other thing that just went really bizarre is I swear in an early scene he had a black patch over his eye, and then he seemed to have a heart patch over his eye for the rest of the film. And I don't know if that was a cut scene or what it was, but even my daughter, who's only, 11, went, what happened with his eye patch? John, what did you think?
Well, the eye patch, I think I can explain by, there was a movie, a fantastic movie, if you haven't seen it. It's not a visual effects film, but it's called The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover.
Yep.
And they do this thing wherever when she walks between different rooms, the color of the room changes, but so does her dress, but it's a seamless transition. And I think that they were trying to do something like that, where when he was near the Red Queen, his black eye patch was red, but when he was away from the Red Queen, the eye patch was black. And I'm pretty sure that was on purpose. And I think it was a stylistic choice. I don't know if I agree with it, but
it didn't happen enough, or if it did happen up, I didn't read from it. It just felt like a mistake. But okay, I might let's say that I'm a Philistine and I lost that particular visual subtlety from Ken's team. What about the actual body performance of Stain?
Well, I would like to. You went medieval, so I'm not going to go medieval. I'm just going to go medieval adjacent. I think that medieval adjacent. I think that, saying that you were looking at everything else is a little bit of what South Park would call the Chewbacca defense. It's this sort of distractionary defense. The visual effects on him were so bad that when we were watching it, I saw it in 3D, and I saw it with Laura Lee, my wife, and she looked over when he first appeared and then jumped on the horse, she looked over and said, "What the hell is wrong with that character?" I mean, she didn't understand the nuances of what was wrong, but she knew something was wrong enough to even, you know, pull herself out of the film and ask me what it was. So my perspective on him, even before she said anything, was he was just a big piece of rubber. I didn't find it believable at all. I was extremely disappointed in that character relative to the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Beowulf, but the rest of the characters were, you know, at a much, much higher level.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think you really nailed it, Mike, with your comment about how it was kind of like a high-end video game. That he felt like a video game cutscene to me more than a movie. And that was really, really disappointing, especially when you look at the production stills and you realize, you know, 90% of this film is created. I mean, these characters are literally walking around inside of big, giant green screens with just a few props. And then even so, their bodies are, you know, transmogrified and transmorphed into these completely different things. And of course, in the case of him, his entire body is a fabrication. But at the same time, Tweedledee and Tweedledum are both complete fabrications, up to and including their head being modified. So I don't really think that's an excuse for
how
he turned out.
I think that, yeah, Tweedledum and Tweedledee were really good. I was going to get to those in a second, and Matt Lucas. And I think that they were very successful, and I thought that that enhanced their performance and stuff. But before I get to that, or maybe instead of it, I should flag that I was having a go at the Arnold renderer. The fur rendering on the hound, especially when she climbs up over his nose to get on his back, I mean, I literally took a breath in. I thought that was just so... I mean, I have a dog. I love dogs. The detail on the hair, on the face, the quality of the characteristics of the shaders, the ability to have a dog that was simultaneously looked like a real dog but also was talking but didn't look like they just stuck a mouth on vis-a-vis Cats and Dogs or its sequel. I just thought that that was like, you know, that was somebody, I would put that on my showreel if that was that guy, and happily just nothing else. And again, it was one of those things that the hound was so good and then, you know, you would almost cut back to the chase with the Staines kind of horse animation body stuff. It was just a shame. Because, I mean, did anyone else just think that hound looked really good, especially in the close-ups?
I love the hound. I thought that was great. But it's interesting, Mike. You do bring up an interesting point about being so many characters and so many different approaches to the visual effects that some are so much better than others that it probably does take you out of the film when one's not as good as the hound. And I just wonder whether that brings up another issue of you're watching a film like this, which is set in a fantasy land. You kind of have to give in to that. You have to realize that.
But I'm totally doing that on the trees, which were non-realistic, and yet Nightmare Before Christmas, beautiful, gorgeous. There was that laneway shot where the Cheshire Cat was. I thought the Cheshire Cat worked in every respect. I love Stephen Fry. I think he's just one of the best British actors, but his voice is so distinctive that normally it overtakes the character, and I just see Stephen Fry, and I didn't do that. The Cheshire Cat, I really was like happy with the Cheshire Cat and sort of lost Stephen Fry in that character, which is remarkable given how much I like Stephen Fry. So in that scene, and it was not in any way a realistic scene, and yet I was totally there, totally bought it, loved it to death, thought that the guys deserved, you know, 1,000 praises. And overall, I think the film deserves 1,000 praises. But in the respect of Stain, I don't think it's me not, you know, giving over to the fantasy world. I didn't have any problem with, you know, some of the breaking of the laws of physics or whatever that was going on. I was totally cool with that. But unfortunately, it was not something that was in the fantasy genre. Getting on a horse is not in the fantasy genre. And so you kind of want it to look right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I guess
you're never going to come back on the show. I've just been really mean to you this week.
Not at all. No.
I got out on the wrong side of the bed. No, but, you know.
The thing about my reaction to the film overall, I know we're talking about specific characters, but was that you start off in, you know, the countryside in the real world, and you go into Wonderland or Underland, and you either actually buy it straight away or not. And I think even though you know it's fantasy, and I think the difference with this film was that you buy it on an individual character level. So you believe the caterpillar, you believe Tweedledum, Tweedledee, and you're probably right based on how good the character is portrayed by the particular voice actor or, you know, whoever it was.
I mean, when we went into Underworld, that bottle on the table, that room, that particularly like the label on the bottle was the point at which I kind of went, oh yeah, this is a Tim Burton film. Like, there was such exquisite aging on the label of the little bit of paper, the just the art direction, the color, the antiqueness of it all, that I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to enjoy this after all. And I could get that from that first scene, no characters, her in the room. I was just suddenly awash with memories of how much I love Tim Burton stuff. And I'd kind of walked into it just forgetting, I did not know that it was Tim Burton, but I was just sort of thinking more, it's going to be wacky. And then I was like, oh, wait a second, this could be exquisite. And I love that attention to detail, just beyond belief. But the trouble is, because I love it so much, because he's so good at it, and his team and the production department are so good at it, then when something else doesn't quite come up to scratch, it's harsh. But anyway, I don't think, pick on Stain too much, because I don't want to make it sound like that ruined the film for me. It just wasn't as strong. Hey, I wanted to ask you guys about the 3D, so let's discuss that. And Ian, you brought up this whole idea the point about before you entered Underworld. For me, the stereoscopic problems were first and most apparent in that live-action sequence pre-going down, which may make sense from a technical point of view, is because obviously you've got green screen elements. It's easier to do a 3D extraction when you already have the separate elements, and especially if you're producing 3D CG environments. But Ian, did you find the 3D stereoscopic effect pre-going down the rabbit hole to be successful?
No. No, there's a particular shot, I don't know whereabouts it is, but there's a tree on the right-hand side of frame.
As they're approaching yep, absolutely.
It didn't look right.
Oh, absolutely.
That tree.
So I don't know what happened there. I don't know whether they were trying to make it a little bit fantasy or something like that, but everyone in my group went, whoa, what's this? And we actually took off our glasses, you know, raised it above our foreheads and just looked at each other. So it wasn't a good start.
That was that tree, and I'll tell you the other one, was when they were in the parlor, there was a defocused foreground actor and behind him an in-focus background mid-ground actor, and it's a shot low looking up past the first guy to the second guy, and they had, in a cinematic sense, a valid shot because it was very much out of focus. The focus was pulled to the back character. Trouble is, in the stereoscopic world, it just grated me like nothing on earth because my eyes moved to looking at the foreground character because he was foreground, and of course it didn't come into focus, and it was immediately a red flag to me. It's like, I don't think this shot is designed well for stereoscopic, and somebody shouldn't have designed a shot this early in the film that's that heavy, that's that stereoscopically stacked, that's that sort of like hard to resolve. What do you think, John?
I completely agree with both observations. I also point out that when Alice is following Nivens McTwisp, the rabbit, through the sort of maze of shrubbery, you know, that shrubbery maze, I felt a kind of, I don't even really know how to describe the feeling. It's that kind of Blair Witch feeling that you have where you're just like, I can't look at the screen right now. You know, I have to turn away because it's so unsettling visually. And, you know, with those glasses on, you already get these strange kind of strobing effects when something moves too quickly or when something is not quite stereoscopically sound. And that entire running, following the rabbit, that entire scene to me just felt like a whirlwind of an assault on my visual cortex. I did not enjoy it in the least bit. And I have to ask, and I know what the budget was on this film. It was about $250 million. I checked a couple of sources. And I just have to ask, why? That's my only question. Why would somebody shoot something two-dimensionally and then go through this extreme process to convert it to 3D when it seems to me, maybe I'm being naive, but it seems to me that the process of shooting with two cameras would be simpler?
Well, I think...
I just don't get it.
I think I don't know the answer to that definitively, but one could take some educated guesses. I mean, I don't know of any 3D stereo Dulce rig, for example. Those Dulce cameras are enormous. And so you'd have had to have designed entire rigs. And that whole approach when they did this production, doing that 4K stuff with the head and stuff, they were shooting on Genesis for the rest. And again, Genesis cameras traditionally aren't used in those rigs unless you're breaking apart the recording mechanism from the head and doing F900 virtually kind of approach. I think that there were some cinematography decisions that they wanted to shoot with certain cameras certain ways, and they really made it incredibly hard to shoot that stereo. Plus, I've got to say that if you take out the beginning bit, the most successful, and take out Avatar, most successful 3D stereoscopic stuff that had been done at the time they were making the decisions was full-on stereoscopic animated, a Pixar Up type, you know, a Beowulf, anything that was completely digitally generated was all, you know, the way to go for 3D. And I think they probably at some point said, well, most of this film's going to be in a virtual environment, and the best way to go 3D is rendering it that way because blah, blah, and then the rest will just... And actually, from what I've gathered, from just snippets I've read around and talking to people off the record, I don't think they'd do it again. Like, I think they won't say that out loud in an interview, but I'm willing to say that if you had exactly this team reformed for Alice in Wonderland 2, which obviously wouldn't happen, that it would be a really... I'd be surprised if they went down the same route again, but that's just a personal opinion. But look, I agree. Like, I just don't think that it, you know, I think they did a good job, an insanely good job on the visual effects. But I can't imagine that they were saying, well, yeah, that was a really great thing. That was a really, because it would have cost millions. I mean, like tens of millions to add that. It wasn't like it was a production saving, like a huge saving to shoot 2D and then do it stereoscopically in 3D. This isn't like a press a button type solution.
Right, and I guess that's my point. And as a technology guy and a kind of a hackery, I want to break things apart and see how they work sort of person, all I could think about is the tens of millions of dollars that they spent on the post side, and if they had just thrown a fraction of that at some smart people, you know, the building of said rig that doesn't exist could happen. It's not exactly brain surgery or rocket science to figure out how to take a camera and modify it to be, something that can shoot 3D. And I think the thing that you said that really hit the nail on the head was, you know, if we ignore Avatar, this is sort of comment of apart from Avatar. That's the problem, though. We can't ignore Avatar. Avatar came out, and now that is literally the standard by which all 3D is going to be judged.
Oh, no, you can't ignore it, and nor should you. But we are talking about production decisions made before Avatar was out, right? I mean, this film would have gone into production and made the decision not to shoot stereoscopically well before we knew that Avatar was a resounding success.
Right. No, I completely agree. But having seen Avatar, we are sadly and viscerally aware of the possibilities, and now every 3D film is kind of has to stack itself up against the, you know, the mountain of chips that exist.
Once you've drunk the good tequila, once you've drunk the good sipping tequila, you don't want the cheap stuff anymore.
Right. I would say vodka, but yeah, same idea.
Really? You've been in Mexico and you're just not... God, I love tequila. I mean, I really like good tequila. God damn it. I would have... Okay. I thought I was playing for a safe joke there. Okay.
Just on the 3D, I have to say, apart from that beginning sequence, the other shots in the film and, say, the end battle sequence... I actually did have fun watching those in 3D, and I felt that they were still quite good.
I thought it was immersive, but didn't you? Mm. I mean, I got weary by the end of it, and it wasn't as long as Avatar. I wasn't weary of my 3D in Avatar, but by the end, I really was like, I want to take the glasses off now, please.
Well, I mean, you know, I think maybe it depends what you're going to the movies for as well as an audience. You're kind of there to have a bit of fun. And
what are you accusing me of?
Nothing, Mike. The only other observation I was going to make was we all thought it was a little bit dull, the projection. I don't know whether that was the cinema I went
dull?
In terms of the light.
Well, stereoscopic. Stick on the ND filters. Yeah.
Of course, no, but in other films I've not felt that as much with the 3D, but I really found this one was a bit too much, that's all.
I'm going to take a second and go on just a small little rant. It'll be brief. So theaters a few years ago, maybe a decade ago now, realized that if they operate the lamp at half power, they can save themselves the cost of replacing the projector, projector's lamp. Mm-hmm. And these lamps cost $3,000-$5,000, which frankly kind of irritates me because it's not that much money. That's why this is a rant. So all of these theaters project their movie at a lesser brightness than the lamp is rated for and than the lamp should be running. And so you're already slightly dimmer than you should be anyway, which already irritates me, plus which they stopped dimming the house lights in the U.S. as much as they used to. They used to take them all the way down, and now they keep them at about 10%.
Really?
Why so? You're fighting? Yeah. So people don't make out or start a fight or throw popcorn or whatever. So you have this problem of the house lights aren't completely dim. You know, there's 17 idiots texting on their iPhones. The projector is running at half power. All of these problems exist. And then you put an ND filter on by virtue of putting on these 3D, glasses. Yeah, it was a dark and murky swirl until I adjusted to it.
I had a much better experience. We turned the lights off. It was a good theater. They were running at full whack. And obviously, I think I agree with you in principle. But the thing is, with the screens, certainly in this country, they've been much more profitable, the 3D screens. So they've been really, bothering to get them right because they're just genuinely making more money from these on a per screen basis. And so they are, of course, the silver screen for the Real D. And I didn't have a projection problem myself, but I may have been just lucky that I'd been to a good, relatively new cinema and it was a good complex. I do agree, though, it's an annoying thing. And I would say that it's far beyond just 3D films, as you say. Like, a lot of those things apply just to a normal film.
Right. And if you're outside of Los Angeles and you're not going to the ArcLight Theater, you're going to experience these problems. I mean, I think the ArcLight is the absolute exception to the rule, but once you get outside of LA, which most people are, by the way, you run into the exact problems that I'm talking about. So I have this kind of, shame on you to these theaters.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, look, I had a real problem like that with Sherlock. We saw Sherlock Holmes. It was so dim that I was stunned. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I just didn't have it on this one. Hey, there were some other interesting things I just want to touch on because I think they were amusing. And I hadn't even occurred to me, but it's one of those classic problems. I think we alluded in a past show to a problem that's going to be coming when they release Dam Busters, in which that they have a dog in that film that in the book and in real life was named Nigger, which is obviously a very offensive term to African Americans, and yet historically became the code name for the success of the mission. And it would be a very difficult problem to know from a filmmaker's point of view whether you stay historically accurate to a period where they did this at the time in England, not to be offensive to African Americans. They did it at the time because they were inadvertently doing it. Because the dog in question was black, Labrador. And that's a big problem for a filmmaker because no one wants to offend a group nor trivialize, decades of racial issues. They have a similar kind of one in this one, which is that the caterpillar is meant to be smoking and this is meant to be like a kid's film. And so it's not on the same level, but these things keep cropping up. You'll get something that historically wasn't offensive and now is. I don't want my kids going and seeing a film where there are cartoony, appealing, wise characters smoking. And yet, of course, the caterpillar smoking in this is a really difficult problem. And so they solved it by having him smoke what seemed to be the most obscure form of way of smoking that my child couldn't possibly get their hands on. it's kind of an interesting thing when you get to these points in literature where we've shifted as a society. And something that was relatively innocent, because I'm sure the bombers on the Dam Busters or Lewis Carroll over a caterpillar smoking in no way saw these as being in any way sensitive issues. And then today they would cause naturally a huge amount of concern. I'm even sort of not 100% comfortable, you know, discussing these terms without myself at risk of offending people. So what do you think the approach should be to these situations where stuff comes up that is just sometimes it's sort of like quite an important plot point, and yet modern sensibilities dictate that we perhaps go a different way?
I'm not sure about that. I think that in the original cartoon, didn't, you know, they were eating mushrooms and things like that, Mike. So there's sort of these allusions, aren't there, to sort of bad behavior or psychedelic stuff. And the smoking, they kind of got away with it a little bit, didn't they, by not showing it directly. But it is tricky.
I mean, if you're talking about some things, you could just say, oh, it's political correctness. But obviously, with the Dam Buster situation, it goes way beyond political correctness to just downright being offensive. But by the same token, you know, historically actually a fact as opposed to an interpretation. In the case of the smoking, it's, you know, values just change. What do you think, John? Am I being overly PC?
Well, I just spent 9 months in Latin America walking around and having literally everyone there call me güero, which means white boy. And it's both a compliment and kind of a... It's not an insult, but it's a way of pointing out that I'm different. So, and females are called güera or güera. And so I heard, you know, güero and negro and all of these different words constantly as I was traveling around through there. And I came back to the U.S. and aside from being struck by the vast number of rules, I feel like I can't walk down the street without breaking the law. I have to say that I've often, this is a little bit of a sore point for me, because I've often thought that this culture that I'm in right now, which is the United States, we have a little bit of sand in our shorts about a lot of things. When I was growing up, people who were professors and people who were wise used to smoke a pipe, and I didn't think anything of that. And in my world, Alice in Wonderland is not a children's story. It is a story that has a lot of references, a lot of political references to what was going on during that time. And I think that's how Carol intended it, is this kind of subterfuge to criticize the current state of affairs in our political system. And I feel like there are certain things that are historically accurate, and we as a society need to get over whatever position we have where we think that it's wrong to say something that's true. I mean, what's the alternative, Mike? We end up rewriting history so that we take out all the offensive things in it?
No, I'm not saying that that at all, actually. I'm just saying that it's an interesting problem for filmmakers, because I would say, you know, if this was an adaptation of 1984 and I'm got the rats in the cage jumping at the face, then I'm like, well, but I don't expect this to be in any way relevant to kids. But, you know, speaking as a parent of two kids, like, I totally expect that my kids will see Alice in Wonderland, because whether it was intended as a children's story or not, there's so much childlike attached popular culture to it that, you know, you've got to know that kids are going to see it. And so I think the smoking is like, I didn't have any problem with it in this film. But I'm just saying there is a continuum of issues like this, and it's not a visual effects question, but I just thought it was an interesting problem, because at some point, is there no line you can't cross?
I think that's ultimately where we're going to head if people don't draw a line somewhere and say, I'm ignoring it. I think it's funny. My feeling was that the Absalom, was the name of the caterpillar, by the way. My feeling was that Absalom was actually smoking opium. It looked like an opium pipe. And so I thought it was sort of ironic that we're creating this very strange kind of hookah that no one has ever seen, but it's very opium-like in its design and in the way that it works. And so I found that sort of funny, that in order to get away from being offensive and get into this odd pipe that no one could actually smoke, we end up having the caterpillar smoking opium. So I wonder how parents would feel if they knew that the caterpillar was not only smoking, but was smoking opium.
Something far worse.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, it's an interesting solution to a problem, right? Because you get, one of the reasons I went on too long about the PC thing, but one of the things I thought was that the particle system stuff, both for the smoke that he was blowing and for the vaporization of the Cheshire Cat was very effective. I mean, I thought the particle wispy volumetric stuff was just really nice in this film. But yeah, I just don't think there's a simple answer to this, but I was just curious to see whether you guys had an opinion on where that falls, because I think filmmakers get faced with these things every once in a while. And, you know, if you're talking about something that is just disturbing because it was killing Christians with lions, then you can sort of just argue, well, that's a disturbing part of history. But then there are these other things that are more, I think, socially loaded in terms of value statements and shifting opinions. And I don't know that I don't know I'm on the same page with you, John. I think there is sensibilities to be played to a modern audience just because you can inadvertently, in the nature of being not afraid, actually just cause people distress unnecessarily. And I don't necessarily want to do that. That wouldn't be the point of my film. My film, or the film that I'd be working on, wouldn't be out to do that. So it would be taking you out of the film in the same way that a visual effect badly done is taking you out of the film.
I suspect that I'm not in much of a position to talk about this, having both never won an Academy Award or been nominated, and having put a rough cut of a film on my website that probably drops the F-bomb every third word of every sentence. So I'm probably not the right guy to ask about sensibilities in film.
Well, just in summing up then, I think that without a doubt, there is magnificent work in this film from a visual effects point of view. I think Ken Rolfson and the team at Sony and the other people that worked on it. Oh, by the way, there was used on this film, I was going to make a little note to mention this, was the encoder cam. You know, the on-set system, I think they use it on iRobot, where you basically encode the heads of the cameras. We haven't discussed previous much, but there was a lot of production design work and stuff done for this. And when you're working in these giant green screen stages, to get actors to be able to have any idea what's going on, having virtual 3D sets live keyed on set with an encoded head. And if you're interested in that, EncoderCam has a website, which is quite good to check out. And they don't have any Alice in Wonderland stuff on it yet. But I remember investigating quite heavily during iRobot. And it's, as you'd expect it to be, EncoderCam.com. But I think that's a really valuable tool if you're going to go down this route and get actors basically just acting to green. You really need to keep in mind how to do things. And I've got a feeling that Ken Rolfson is so experienced and so successful that he would have probably insisted on that, because he knows how to make sure that the visual effects work for a story. And I think this film was very, very successful in a visual effects sense, even though I didn't have a problem with Stain. And I think that stereoscopically, I hope it points to us deciding this is probably not the way to do stereoscopic work. I don't think it ruined the film, but I don't think I would encourage people to go down that path again. But that's just my two cents. What about you, John, in summary?
In summary, I completely agree with you. I think that not doing this is exactly the right idea. The one thing that we didn't talk about that I just want to have a little shout out for is the Bandersnatch. I would like to just say to the team or teams of persons that worked on the Bandersnatch that that was such an amazing piece of art to create that character. It was frightening. It moved with a fluidity that I have not seen in a long, long time. And you guys, whoever you are out there, are unbelievably talented. I hope you continue to do such great work. It was
good, wasn't it? Yeah.
Mm.
And what about you, Ian?
I think, you know, the companies that worked on it, Imageworks and Cafe FX and a few others, great. And one thing that I wanted to say was I enjoyed the closing titles too. They were done by Asylum, I think.
And weren't they good?
And were great. Very subtle, the plants growing sort of slowly on the side. And, of course, it was in 3D. And, yeah, I really love when the closing titles or the credit sequence is something to stay and watch for. So, yeah, all in all, really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Well, that has been our dissertation on interesting things beginning with the letter A. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to follow us and talk to us, send us abusive emails and think that I'm too politically incorrect, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. And John, how's the best way for people to find you or see what you're up to now you're back?
Well, if you Google Life Zero, I'm the top seven 15,000 hits or something like that, so that's an easy way to find me. But I'm also at lifezero.org and on the Twitter at lifezero.
And you're doing more podcasts now you're back from your travel, so we can look forward to some more stuff from the Life Zero team, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm resurrecting that post show, which I'm really excited about. That post show is oddly one of the most popular podcasts that I've done, and I've had a lot of comments about, you know, where is it, when is it coming back, these kind of things. So rest assured, it's on its way. I have a whole year of stuff lined up to do.
Excellent. And Ian, I can just recommend people read your story on FX Guide about Alice, but where can people follow you? You have your own personal site and Twitter account.
I do. It's vfxblog.com and vfxblog at Twitter, obviously. So thanks a lot.
And thank you guys for listening and being with us. We really appreciate it. We have some great stuff coming up. And as always, check us out at www.vfxshow.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much. Bye.